time, a little bit late. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. I'm Dick, and you're also going to be hearing Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to organize a thing called the Technical Net, in which amateur radio operators come together and share information. We help each other. It's sort of a minor school. It's a gathering of the clan in which we discuss our favorite subjects of transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and antennas and propagation and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. A person signs into the Technical Net by telling Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in if you do not have a question or a comment, that you're just listening. After 27 and a half years, by now we sort of believe there are people listening. This is TechNet number 1,303 of the series that began in September of 1982. We believe this is one of the longest running nets in ham radio, and certainly it may be the longest one with reference to the hours of operation, which is now something like 3,500 hours or something like that. We're running as much as 4 hours on Sunday nights these days. Let me drop. It used to be a one-hour show, and it slowly crawled up to 4 hours, starting at 8 o'clock, and sometimes they don't even stop at midnight. These guys get so enthusiastic. So give me your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, listening.
November to X-ray Juliet, November. And to XJN, Wesley, yes.
WS2N. Paul, good evening, Dick, with a yes.
So far, we've got Wesley and Paul. Anyone else to check into the Technical Net? Or is everybody still recovering from the field day operation? And we'll be interviewing people a little bit later to find out what was field day like for you. So except for Wesley and Paul, who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening. This is K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
W-H-Y-Y, Joe. Yeah, I'll have a question for the TechNet 2 weeks from now because maybe I'll be able to get that answer then.
Okay, Joe. Something about 2 weeks, you said. Signal's a little bit noisy. So apparently for 2 weeks you've been seeking an answer, and we'll be getting to you. And a little bit unhappy that I didn't get to see Mel last night, or the Saturday night, Sunday morning. Was that last night? Yeah, it was last night. Didn't get a chance to get out to see you guys. A couple of crazy things happened at my house last night. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check into the Technical Net? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
K2J.
Eric recognized. And should I put you down for a question or a comment? Eric, go ahead.
No, I do want to tell you that the repeater now has a nice new antenna, so Mel should sound pretty good, even with sleep power.
Yeah, I've been hearing you doing some testing with various people. I just heard Peter, W2SET, drive into Bayville, which is over the hill from the repeater, and his signal in the past has normally been quite noisy, and it wasn't tonight. And I guess the previous antenna used to have a null in its pattern toward the southwest, toward Frenchtown, New Jersey, where we share the same frequency. We also share the same frequency with Torrington, Connecticut. So this new antenna, I presume, has a more omnidirectional pattern. Being new, it doesn't have the scratchies problem on a windy night. Probably the gain is about the same, or maybe even a little bit lower, but just have
a bit less.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about it, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the old antenna was 4 folded dipoles that I actually have now in the back of my car because the pole was too damn long to bring down. The phasing harness was falling apart. The connector inside the pole itself was bad. It would get wet. It did a lot of bad things. The wind would blow. It would completely disconnect, actually. That antenna had 8 dB and change in its forward lobe. The pattern of that antenna was sort of a cardioid, but not really. It had sort of a flat back and a little bit of a frontal lobe that was kind of an egg-shaped. We're now using an antenna that's perfectly It is omnidirectional, and it's got a couple of bumps in it in terms of its takeoff angle, and that's where the gain is. Its gain, it's a collinear array, and it's about 6.9 dB.
So you went for an apparent 8 dB of gain on the forward lobe of the previous cardioid pattern to a little shy of 7 dB of gain, but and yes, there are lobes. Almost any collinear antenna will have lobes in the elevation pattern. Is the elevation beam width significantly different between old and new? Eric, go ahead.
Actually, it's quite significant, and it's a little bit bumpy. There's about four fingers to it.
Okay. I think you're saying the total altitude of the antenna in vertical wavelengths is longer on the new one than it was on the old one. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it is. And the actual physical length of this antenna is 19 and a half feet.
Okay, from that I can assume that it has a nearly uniform power distribution across the 19.5 feet. I can therefore fit into a mathematical formula and figure out what the vertical beam width is. In the old antenna, which made out of, I think you said, four folded dipoles, what gave it that cardioid pattern? I think ordinarily they will set two of the dipoles to the north and two of them to the south. Maybe you guys change things around a little bit to put all four of them to the north, if you know what I mean. Is that what was creating the front-to-back ratio, which created a partial null toward Frenchtown? Back to you, Eric.
That's absolutely correct, Mr. Antenna.
Now, you would think at first that the amount of shielding you would get from the mast that all four dipoles on one side is mounted to, being a non-resonant structure, would be partially transparent and not create much of a null. I'm going to guess it sucked down the signal toward Frenchtown by a few dB, but not a really deep null. I think you said it created sort of a flat back lobe that was, would you say, 5 dB weaker or so? Eric, go ahead.
Well, I know what the manufacturer says in their given pictures. But yeah, it's about 5 to 6 dB. It was pretty flat in the back. You can think of it as flat more than it is a cardioid, but, you know, it's the right kind of shape.
Now, you did that installation, I'm going to guess, Friday morning. Is that approximately right?
Well, the rigger did the installation Friday morning.
Yeah, but you were the Cyborg superintendent that ran the operation. And so roughly by noontime on Friday is when the new antenna went into operation, and the repeater, out of curiosity, the repeater was turned off for what length of time during the installation?
Yeah, I turned the repeater off at about 9:30, and I had to go to work, so I went to work. They were pretty much done, I guess, at about 11:30, because I also wanted them to cut the... There's a 7/8 inch coax that goes up there. It's only a short piece, but I wanted to be absolutely sure it wasn't wet, so I made them cut off the end and put a nice new connector on it and do it upright for me. And Andy tried to turn it on, a few other people tried to turn it on, but when I finally called to say, hey, what's going on, you done yet? Because I was in a location where there was no cell phone activity, so it's down in the basement of the kind of a video post-production place, so. And when I found out they were finished, turned it back on.
Okay, so your 7/8 inch Andrew Heliax, I'm going to guess, probably foam-filled, non-pressurized type that doesn't require pressurization. You cut off the end, so it's got a nice fresh end that you're sure no water is in it. I presume a new jumper cable went from there to the actual antenna, a flexible link, possibly. And, is the new antenna approximately the same altitude above the roof of the building, or is there a change in altitude in the new installation? And maybe the change in altitude is the effective altitude because of 19.5 feet of length. Wow. And I wonder on a windy day if that's going to whip around a little bit. Back to you, Eric, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, considering the old antenna, it's amazing harness and everything, with two sections of, I think it was 16-foot pipe or 18-foot pipe. You can figure the distribution of the loops. You actually have more effective antenna area, if you want to think of it that way. But, you know, electrically, you know, you can't, just because it's 19 feet doesn't mean you have electrically 19 feet of antenna.
It is a station master-like antenna, I'm guessing, where it has a bunch of semi-rigid coax pieces that are each a half wavelength long electronically crisscrossed. And then the top piece, I think they usually make that one, a quarter wavelength long with a short circuit at the end of it. Is that approximately the method of feeding the antenna at the bottom with an impedance matching device?
That's precisely the method, and it's a super duper whoopee doo super station master made by RFS, which was bought from a company called Phelps Dodge.
So Phelps Dodge bought whoever used to make Station Master, or maybe Station Master made Phelps Dodge, and now the company is RFS. Who was the manufacturer of the original Station Master? Was that Phelps Dodge?
That was Phelps Dodge. Phelps Dodge was absorbed by Radio Frequency Systems, which is a very large manufacturer of broadcast antennas.
So you've had quite a bit of contact with them by way of your broadcast experience. So, the actual place where the new antenna is mounted is the actual mounting hardware at approximately the same altitude as the old one, Eric?
WB2HWW, comment please.
Yeah, when I finish, Howie.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the mounting hardware, you have to remember the story of the antenna. The antenna was originally on the top floor of Glen Oaks. And about, what was it, 2 years ago, I had Billy move it up to the top of the elevator shaft, so that gave it an extra 40 feet. And there's a grid up there where he has all these antennas mounted, all carefully numbered and placed, and the previous antenna is in a mount on the corner of this grid frame, and the new antenna is in exactly the same clamping assembly as the old one was. Go ahead, Dick.
Now, the old antenna, you said, was a pair of 16-foot pipes. Maybe they were telescoped together. What was the total length of the old antenna, Eric?
I think it was about 36 feet.
Wow. 36 feet was the old one. So, a pair of 16-foot pipes, not including the telescoping. My goodness, that must have whipped around in the wind if it was only held at the bottom without any guy wires. Did you ever see that thing move around on a windy day? What was the diameter of that bottom pipe?
It was, I don't remember. I think it was either a 2-inch pipe or 2.5-inch pipe. It was real thick, heavy stuff. I mean, it was just too big that Billy just, he brought up a sawzall and cut the thing up. So that's why I only have the loops.
When I put up Roan 55 Tower, and for a short period of time, I was standing 40 feet above the top guy wire. My goodness, is that a whippy structure with me on the top of it. And Roan 55 is extremely heavy-duty pipe equivalent, let's say. It's got 18 inches of face dimension and I think it's inch and a half diameter, schedule 40 or schedule 80 steel pipe. So 40 feet of tower section, well mounted on a bunch of towers below it with a taut set of guy wires. That is a whippy structure. You take a 2-inch or a 2.5-inch diameter pipe, 36 feet long. I'll bet you on a windy day the top of that must have moved back and forth 8 feet or some crazy number. So, a lot of flexing was going on that structure, in my opinion. Howie, go ahead with your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just like to know how I'm making it in with the new antenna, and I also wanted to ask Eric. Telwave now makes the Station Master. From what I've heard, that RFS is not putting as much BWAX into the Station Master, because if I buy a new antenna, it's going to be Telwave. Go ahead, Eric.
You're talking about Telwave. That was one of the choices, but if you look at the physical structure between the telwave, which I have a couple of telwaves, and I have the RFS, I'll take the RFS any day. Thank you, Howard.
Do they still make the PD-455? Are you telling me, and I'm very curious if you can explain it, Are you saying that the RFS do make a better antenna? Because I heard all kinds of rumors that they're having problems with the joints on the 22-foot station master, on the super station master for 440 to 450. But you're saying that RFS is still making a better product, Eric?
All I know is what I've seen, Howie, and I happen to know somebody at RFS and had a conversation with them, and, you know, I buy my broadcast antennas from them, and, you know, everybody likes this flavor or that flavor. You may like chocolate, I like vanilla.
Okay, I'm just curiosity, no comment. Let me pull over to Dick, KQRIWWB2HWW, as you may know, Dick, these are not cheap antennas.
Yeah, I suspected that. In the early days, the station masters made by Phelps Dodge, I think once they set the pieces of, oh, I guess it's quarter-inch semi-rigid, maybe it's 3/8 semi-rigid coax cable pieces all together with spacers, they essentially filled up the whole fiberglass radome with beeswax. And I'm not quite sure that that's the best way to go. With the right kind of spacers and having more air in there than beeswax, you have a little bit more control of dielectric constant, you have a lower mass structure, and therefore it could be better. So the amount of beeswax may not be the whole determining factor of the quality and survivability of these antennas. For those who are not quite sure what we're talking about the so-called vertical stacked collinear antenna. It's a bunch of dipoles above each other, end-to-end, vertically stacked, various ways of feeding it as individual folded dipoles with a phasing harness, or by way of feeding them in a crisscross manner where they all connect to each other end-to-end, and you feed the bottom of the structure. And because the power does get a little bit dissipated by the time it gets to the top, you end up with a little bit of a energy distribution. The top of the antenna is getting a slightly weaker signal than the bottom, and that has a slight effect on the pattern. But a collinear array, let me drop. If you could see the antenna pattern in three-dimensional space, it would look somewhat like a pancake. Rather narrow and vertical beam width, and that vertical beam width is primarily a function of the number of wavelengths from top to bottom of the antenna. A rough rule of thumb is that you take 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths of that particular dimension. This is the elevation dimension, the height dimension. Divide the number of wavelengths into 70 degrees, and it gives you a good approximation as to the vertical elevation angle, 3 decibel beam width. Let's see, 19.5 feet on 2 meters. Let's see, that's very close to 20 feet. I'll have to work out the mathematics of that. Let's see. That's around 6 meters, right? 20 feet? Let me think. Yeah, it's about 3 wavelengths. 3 wavelengths into 70 degrees is, what, around 15 or so degrees? Yeah. We'll eventually figure that out as to what the vertical beam width is. And that's where the gain is coming from. You're not wasting power by squaring it at high angles above the horizon or low angles below the horizon. This pancake pattern, maybe with a little bit of town tilt to it, is aimed primarily at the horizon. Omnidirectional in azimuth, relatively narrow in elevation beam width, and therefore without violation any conservation of energy laws, you can end up with numbers like 8 or 9 dB of gain. Maybe a little bit less than that, but you can see where the gain is coming from. Okay, let's go over to our first questioner.
Dick, one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Derek.
Just for Howie's benefit, if you do buy Telwave, they put a UV coating on the outside of the antenna, which kind of guarantees a minimum 30-year life before the fiberglass starts to break down. The latest version of the Station Masters has an impregnated material in the fiberglass, which is essentially supposed to do the same thing, where it doesn't allow the UV to break the fibers down. But, there's a plus. Also, the RFS antenna is a bit sturdier, and the fiberglass is a bit thicker than the Telwave. That's why the Telwave is considerably cheaper.
Thank you for that information, Eric. Just curiosity. One of these days, we're going to have to replace it. The antenna's coming up to about 20 years at our site.
Eric, when it comes comes to single antenna site repeater operation, where you're transmitting and receiving out of the same antenna, what's your rough guess as to a properly cared for antenna in that environment? Is 20 years life more than you should expect? What do you think, Eric?
Well, I mean, you want to consider the folded dipoles. That should last forever. The problem with that is that you're going to have to replace the harness, the phasing harness once in a while. Unless, of course, you're using some kind of air dielectric coax for the phasing harness and the feed line. I mean, even three-quarters hard line, the newest stuff, like if you're buying Andrew, if you had bought LDF-5, let's say, LDF-5 has a lifetime, guaranteed 20 years. The new stuff, which is AVA, AVA-5, that has a new foam dielectric, and they're guaranteeing that for something like 35 plus years. So, as far as a fiberglass built antenna, being in the sun every day, you know that those fibers are going to break down from being hit by UV. If you want to see an antenna that's only been up for like 15 years and see the fiberglass jetting, I've got one in the back of work. So, you figure 20 years is that's a pretty good average life. And with the UV coatings that they're using today, you can expect a little bit more.
So without a UV coating, the fiberglass starts breaking down, powdering, and starts looking fuzzy on the surface, and starts losing some of its strength. Is that approximately what happens? And maybe even starts absorbing some water?
Yeah, actually, it's not the fiberglass that breaks down. It's the resin that holds it together.
I understand. The whole fiberglass structure. The resin, of course, I'm trying to think of what the name is now for epoxies. Epoxy-like substances are really two chemicals coming together that harden. Unfortunately, they never stop hardening. They become brittle after a while, particularly with ultraviolet exposure. Quite a few of the VHF, UHF antennas I've installed on my tower over the years, portions of them were held together with epoxy adhesive. And the experience I've had is anything I've held together with epoxy within 2 years, that particular piece is on the ground because it came apart from embrittlement with the fiberglass fibers in there. Of course, you get quite a bit longer life out of it, but still. Since the new antenna, you didn't mention having a ultraviolet coating on it, are you at all concerned, or is the ultraviolet protective materials built into the resin of the antenna itself? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. There's a chemical compound that's mixed in with the epoxy resin, so it is a UV, not absorbing, but a UV reflecting material. It's different than having a UV coating, because the coating covers the standard resin. This resin has the UV stuff in it, so a different philosophy, but same idea.
Okay, good luck with the new antenna. Where I think we're going to see the greatest benefit is on a very windy, rainy night. The older antenna on a windy, rainy night had a whole lot of excess noise and signals that normally would be...
Actually, if you pushed the antenna about an inch, it would completely disconnect. That's how bad it was.
How did you find that out, Eric? Because I can't believe you stood 32 feet above the mounting structure and pushed on it. Maybe you waved it at the bottom.
We pushed on it with a long stick. I mean, Andy and I and Billy were up there. We also wiggled the cable on the bottom to the bottom of the pipe actually had a mount in it with an end connector. So you move that and you snap crap on pop.
And you were in that condition for over a year, is that true?
Say that again.
Were you in that condition with that crackly antenna for more than a year?
No, when we discovered that, I started investigating antennas. To replace it with. What we did was we took a whole lot of electrical tape and kind of taped the inside to hold itself still, which actually made an improvement. But, I didn't get the opportunity to really inspect it because Billy cut it up. I didn't see where the end of the phasing harness wound up. But you know that, there was a really bad connection, either a broken shield or a broken center conductor or whatever. I mean, we were lucky we weren't creating an NMOD with a crappy connection like that.
To put a 19.5-foot long antenna on top of a building, I think that's beyond the altitude that you can tolerate with an elevator, even if you open up the trap door on the top of the elevator and let the antenna stick upward. My guess is you might have to haul that antenna up the outside of the building. Is that what took place?
Negative. We brought it up the stairwell. Well, if you want to think about things like that, when the World Trade Center went down, I put on Empire on the 81st floor as we moved as we prepared to move from Alpine back to a nice tall space that people could actually pick up television. I had to bring up eight FA Delta Wing antennas, and they barely fit in the elevator shaft. So what we did was we got a couple of riggers, and we put the antennas on top of the elevator to bring them up to the 81st floor. So, you know, when you think about it, there's always a way.
Wow. So I think you said you took the antenna apart as much as you could, but each of the bat wings had to be independently brought up by putting them on top of the elevator, stopping the elevator below the floor that you wanted, opening up the doors in an unusual procedure to take the antenna out from the top of the elevator, the piece of the antenna that you were holding up. And about three or four pieces like that had to be hauled up. Am I guessing somewhat right? Go ahead.
Yeah, I actually split the antenna in half if we were able to do that. And one section at a time, what we would do is bring the top of the elevator up to the floor level, a little bit below the floor level, the 81st floor, and kind of finagle and tilt the antenna out of the elevator shaft. And we did that eight times.
Eight times. In other words, the antenna was broken into eight individual pieces, or you had other pieces of hardware. How tall were the individual pieces that you were bringing up that way, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, let's see. I actually have those antennas now, well, similar antennas, sitting in the backyard of the TV station. I would say one bay is about, I don't know, I guess about 18 feet, 20 feet, something like that.
18 or 20 feet high for one bay, and I think you said you brought the you took the antenna apart into two separate pieces, in halves, yet you did that procedure four times, I think you said, so I'm not quite sure what the four separate trips were for. Go ahead.
It was two bays of four, so it was eight bays. We broke it down into each individual bay, so there were eight of them. So there were eight trips, and the mounting poles weren't a big deal because you could, you know, the service elevator, you can literally pop half the top off of it and stick the long poles in it and, you know, have them stick out the top of the elevator, and you just bring the elevator up to the floor level when you have enough ceiling height to be able to get the poles out of the elevator, so that wasn't a big deal.
Some elevators have a main hauling up cable that is attached to, let's say, the ceiling, the center of the ceiling of the elevator. Some other kinds of elevators have cables that run around the perimeter of the elevator. They're flat to the wall. The elevator in the Empire State Building, which kind is that, Eric? Go ahead.
They have both, but the ones that we were using was a service elevator, which was built when the building was built. Let's see if I can remember. Actually, I'm looking at a picture of it. I took a picture of it. I don't remember whether it was 8 or 16 individual cables that were centered around a girder that ran in the center of the elevator that was a steel structure that, you know, was basically a cage with walls.
Okay, so, was any of the vertical hauling cables, some of which maybe came to the center of the ceiling of the elevator, were they in the way of the structures that you were hauling up? Go ahead.
Actually, no, but what we did do is we clamped the top of the antenna to the cable to keep it from wiggling around.
Can you imagine how much trouble you get into if you overhaul the elevator to too high an altitude? Once you took the eight bays, out of the elevator by dropping the elevator down a floor and opening up the doors, how then did you get these great big structures from inside the building, outside the building? Was there a window somewhere at the 89th floor that's big enough to do that? Go ahead.
Well, that's the nice part about the Empire State Building and the 81st floor setback. The windows are very, very big. I mean, they're really big. And the old-fashioned windows, they slide up like they you have in your house. But actually, what we did was we passed them through WNYU space, and there, because the cooling for the klaxons were built into the wall, they actually had two windows completely chopped out and steel louver doors put in, and we just opened up the louver doors and passed them right out to the patio deck there.
And then they were holding up the side of the building past the aluminum facade that has the staircase on the outside of the aluminum facade. Is that true?
What aluminum facade? Things made out of brick.
Hold on now. There is an aluminum structure on... There's four bat wings on the four sides of the building near the top that are made out of aluminum. It was a very exotic material way back in the 30s when the building was built. And there's a bunch of rungs coming out of there where you can climb the side of the building. Believe it or not, I did that one night. Back to you, Eric.
All I know is the 81st floor, 81, is where I put these. I'm not talking about the mooring mast. Okay? The whole building is made out of brick. And, you know, it's brick and steel. It's a steel frame with brick and mortar that make up the walls and the structure of the building. I know, I've chopped out the floor. Actually, there are fireplaces from the 80th floor up. There's fireplace flues that we actually ran the cables from the transmitter store.
Considering the outer facade of the building at the floors you're talking about is made out of brick and mortar, has anyone ever worried about that mortar drying out with ultraviolet and wind and ice and everything else, exposure, and eventually loosening to the point where pieces of brick might fall? Over to you, Eric.
Most of the building has this sheathing that you're talking about that covers it all. It's just that when you go right behind it, it's only a thin thing. So, I mean, the bricks don't actually get exposed. But it's all brick.
And the sheeting above the bricks, is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
And that sheeting is made out of what kind of material? And how is it attached?
Well, you know, I can't say how the rest of the building is. I only know the parts that I've been exposed to. And, it's some kind of a glue kind of thing. I mean, some of it doesn't even have it, and they just paint over it.
Fascinating building. A great place to visit. I thought some people would sort of enjoy a little bit of the behind the scenes of the Empire State Building. Empire State Building, ESB, I think a lot of people call it. Okay, Wesley is in the process of assembling more and more test equipment to start doing some pretty elaborate experiments, somewhat like what Tesla was doing, but he's bringing them up to date. And I think one of your experiments was going to be to try to observe the exact quantitative waveform with the wave shape coming out of a Tesla coil. And last week we were discussing a properly used, properly probed, properly decoupled oscilloscope, I think, can do that. I think almost no other instrumentation can really show you the exact waveform you get out of a Tesla coil. So back to you, Wesley, and how's that project going? Sounds like some exciting stuff. N2XJN, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is N2XJN. Is my signal okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Well, actually, I've noticed that based on your words and that you are one special man in the certain areas, and I appreciate that I participate in TechNet. Since I found that the TechNet exists, let me drop. Well, all of the digital multimeters, including very high quality laboratory equipment, actually fail. That means they are still workable, they are still in good shape. they're useless. And I have this old 117 U.S. Navy multimeter that actually gives me the most of valuable information. But I was able to find out the sweet point of oscillation and find out that I was able to get out of the Tesla coil when I was dealing with the secondary winding that it was lower voltage. The resonant point nearby the edge of the spark oscillation zone. When I put 30 volts, I was getting about 1.5 amp. So in other words, the circuit was done this way that I had a generator, signal generator with the square waves, and I was delivering it to the high voltage Tesla coil, trying to mimic the same oscillation and high voltage, and I had a sparking gap. And I found out that the resonant point disregards the fact of how wide is the sparking gap, always exists in the almost at the edge of breaking sparking oscillation. And I found that I was able to get a fraction of the current drawn and the most of the voltage out from that circuitry. But this is not what I was trying to talk about.
Thank you. Frequency, please.
Okay. And I believe some of ham radio operators might be confused with a few devices, and I believe it's a helpful device, and we have Dick, and we have Eric, and we have Glenn, and many others that I would like to ask a few questions. Network analyzer, spectrum analyzer, spectrum network analyzer, scalar network analyzer, vector network analyzer, and one person might be kind of confused at first. I wonder if somebody will try to agree with me with the fact that network analyzers do not have to deal only with the radio waves, but they could actually measure the properties of the transformers, including air transformers with no core or open core transformers. And I would appreciate, Dick, if you gave me input in this area, as this kind of knowledge might help people to understand better. The ham radio is for education, and that's what we do, buying the new device and trying to learn about antennas. At the age of 54 right now, I find myself that I feel better, and I stimulate my brain cells, and of course learn much better English when I talk on the TechNet and try to educate myself. Dick, back to you and to XJ.
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting subjects in there. I made an error one or two weeks ago when you were talking about the new spectrum analyzer-like machine or dynamic signal analyzer that you had purchased that went from a very low frequency up to 40 megacycles. I was speculating that it was a so-called ubiquitous analyzer, the kind that has a digital-to-signal, a digital-to-analog converter in the front end, and then it does digital signal processing. There are two very famous machines made by Hewlett-Packard that do that dynamic signal analysis. It's also called a ubiquitous signal analyzer, spectrum analyzer. They operate by that procedure, analog to digital conversion, but they only go up to 100 kilohertz, and they will go down to a resolution bandwidth of a millihertz, 0.001 hertz of bandwidth, which can give you some very fine frequency resolution. I'm relatively sure the machine that you bought is a spectrum analyzer that works by the frequency scanning technique. In other words, it takes a particular filter, let me drop, that you select for the IF bandwidth, It's called the resolution filter, and by way of a scanning voltage-controlled oscillator in the front end and the superheterodyne technique, it scans across the 0 to 40 megacycles or whichever portion that you want. There are advantages and disadvantages of each. The slight disadvantage of the scanning type is that when you go to the very fine resolution, it must scan very slowly, whereas the kind that uses the digital to analog converter doesn't have to go slowly when it's giving a fine resolution. To use the machine that you've owned for doing a analysis of the signals coming out of a Tesla coil will be a challenge. I didn't say it's impossible, but it will be a challenge. It won't be super easy. A network analyzer is really a signal generator with a synchronous detector. It sweeps across a particular frequency region, and it pours a signal into the circuit being measured. It could be an inductor, a capacitor, a filter, an amplifier fed forward, an amplifier fed backwards. Under normal circumstances, a vector network analyzer and a simpler version of that called a scalar network analyzer. Scalar network analyzer measures amplitude of input to output ratio, but does not keep account of phase. Let me drop. Whereas the vector network analyzer keeps track of what amplitude of signal it's using as it scans across the desired frequency region, keeps track of the phase of the signal it's applying to the circuit under test, and then the response that it measures. It carefully measures the amplitude and the phase angle of the response of the circuit under test, and therefore you can ask it to display the response of your circuit as a polar diagram. You can ask it to display it as a Smith chart. You can ask it to display a rectangular chart where frequency is the horizontal axis and the amplitude axis is vertical, and that vertical axis can be various scales of decibels per centimeter.
Is polar color is the same?
Not necessarily, no. A scalar network analyzer does not keep track of phase. Therefore, in general, a scalar network analyzer cannot give you a polar display. A polar display really is a kind of a circle on the screen where the center dot represents zero amplitude. The actual signal being displayed is a deflection from center toward the perimeter. That amount of deflection from center toward perimeter represents usually voltage amplitude. It could in some cases be decibel amplitude, but it's usually voltage. And whether or not the arrow from center toward the perimeter goes up toward 12 o'clock, that would in many cases be 0 degrees. If it goes from center toward 3 o'clock, that would be 90 degrees. If it went from center toward 6 o'clock, that would be 180 degrees, and so on. So a polar diagram is telling you the relative phase of the response as well as the amplitude of the response, and only a vector network analyzer can really give you that display. And once you have the ability to make that kind of a display, then there is a strong relationship between a polar diagram display and a Smith chart display. The only difference is, let me drop.
Both of them are circular.
Both Smith chart and polar are a circular display with slightly different definitions of the display itself. In the case of a Smith chart, the center of the diagram represents 0 volts of signal being reflected, usually at the input, but sometimes at the output. If you're exciting a signal at the input of a network while the output is, let's say, being terminated, and you're looking at the standing wave ratio at the input, you can ask for, and that standing wave ratio represents a certain magnitude of voltage coming back from your circuit. If your circuit was a perfect 50-ohm load, for instance, all the signal that you poured into it would stay there. As the input impedance of your circuit under test deviates from a 50-ohm resistor. If it goes down to a 25-ohm resistor, that would be a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and that's another way of saying that the reflected signal is about 9.5 dB weaker than the signal that you're putting forward. And 9.5 dB weaker is something in the vicinity of 1/3 of the voltage. So that if you were setting up the vector network analyzer to give you a Smith chart display, and if at this particular time, let me drop, as it scans through your favorite frequency, if your circuit presented a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and it was a purely resistive 2-to-1, like a 25-ohm resistor, that's a fancy way of saying that the signal would be having a 180-degree change in phase as it reflects from the input connector of your circuit under test. And the way the Smith chart is usually set up, 180 degrees of reflection is displayed as a point toward the 9 o'clock position on the Smith chart, the way people normally lay out the Smith chart, with low impedances toward the left side, high impedance resistively toward the right side, capacitive signals toward the bottom, and toward 6 o'clock, and inductive signals toward the top, toward 12 o'clock. So the phase angle of the reflected signal and the amplitude of the reflected signal were to be displayed on that Smith chart. In my particular example of a 25-ohm load at that frequency, it would be a dot on the screen approximately 1/3 of the way from the center toward the 9 o'clock position. That would be that particular frequency. And if you then jump to the next higher frequency, and if the load became a little bit capacitive, your dot would be moving in a circular manner from 1/3 radius, as I described on the first dot, and the line would start moving in a clockwise manner as a circle around the center. And so if I had a circuit that had a certain length of coaxial cable going to it, let me drop, and the circuit was a 25-ohm resistor, and I swept through a significant number of frequencies, and I'm making a measurement of what is the input impedance to the transmission line that's feeding the 25-ohm resistor. A 25-ohm resistor is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, because the coaxial cable transmission line has a certain electrical length to it. As you sweep to higher frequencies, the number of wavelengths of that cable becomes longer, electronically longer in wavelengths as you go to higher frequencies, even though physically measured with your tape measure, it's the exact same length. The net result would be a more delayed phase of reflection as you go to higher frequencies. Therefore, you would get a constant diameter circle 1/3 of the way from the center toward the perimeter of your Smith chart. You draw that circle. That is the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio circle. It will intercept the horizontal axis of the Smith chart. Let me drop. It would intercept the horizontal axis at what, after you normalize the chart, it would be intercepting the axis horizontally. The circle that you're drawing would be at the 25-ohm point on the left-hand side, the 100-ohm point on the right-hand side toward the 3 o'clock, and various amounts of capacitance near 12 o'clock, and inductance near 12 o'clock, and capacitance near 3 o'clock. So when you use the Smith chart function of a vector network analyzer, while it is being asked to display Smith chart response, you would get that constant diameter circle in this example of a 25-ohm resistor. The 25-ohm resistor is a pure resistor. However, because of the way a transmission line acts as a delay device, as you put various frequencies into the input end of that transmission line, you will see all of those various impedances that are represented by that circle I've just described on the Smith chart. That's if you use the vector network analyzer in the conventional manner. There's another very sexy way you can use a vector network analyzer. Let me drop. You could go through a calibration procedure with a vector network analyzer where you want it to electronically subtract out the length of the transmission line that you're forced to use. I mean, rarely do you hang your circuit directly on the connector on the front panel of your vector network analyzer. Quite possibly it is a circuit that is a foot away, or it may be 100 feet away. And so you're going to be feeding your circuit with some kind of high quality transmission line, hopefully. You can then tell the vector network analyzer, I'm now going to the calibration procedure. I'm going to, at the appropriate time when I go through the calibration procedure, I'm going to hang a pure 50 ohm resistor at the end of the transmission line, and I go through one of the steps where it sweeps across my frequency range of interest. In the next step, I hang a perfect short circuit at the end of the transmission line, then a perfect open circuit at the end of the transmission line. I go through these three steps of the calibration procedure, and then I tell the vector network analyzer to go to its 12-point calibration. I tell it to absorb all of that data into its data matrix. And the bottom line is that now, when I hang various components at the end of that transmission line, where the length of that transmission line has been calibrated for my range of frequencies, for my particular piece of cable, now if I hang a 25 ohm resistor at the end of that calibrated transmission line, where I have now referenced the machine to the end, not the beginning, I've referenced the machine to the end of the transmission line, and I put a 25 ohm resistor there, and I sweep through the exact same
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I sweep through the exact same frequencies that I did before, where I got this 2-to-1 standing wave ratio diameter circle. But now that I've calibrated the vector network analyzer to take out my length of cable electronically by way of its calibration, by way of its calibration and calculating procedure, I now hang a 25 ohm resistor, and I sweep from, let me pick a number, 1 megacycle to 100 megacycles, where ordinarily I would go around that Smith chart maybe 20 times in that circle, and now I get a single dot on the left-hand side of the Smith chart that represents 25 ohms. So which kind of vector network analyzer response do you desire? Both of them have a lot of value. In one case, in my first case, I find out what impedance am I going to see from the point of view of my transmitter when it's feeding the bottom end of my transmission line in the shack and the antenna is on the other end. That was the first test I described, where if it was a perfect antenna that stayed 25 ohms resistance, I would get the circle on the Smith chart. Then I can go, if I desire, to the second calibration procedure of a vector network analyzer, and now it is telling me, after it electronically takes out the length of my transmission line, and that transmission line could be an inch long, or it could be 200 feet long. If the vector network analyzer is a good enough one, it will electronically remove that particular piece of cable with all of the characteristics of that cable. I'll get into that in a minute. And now the display you get on the Smith chart is the true impedance of the antenna all by itself, as if that antenna, even though it's a great big antenna that's 19 and a half.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Even though it might be an antenna that's 19 and a half feet long, and it's really 75 feet away from my transmitter, I can get a display on that vector network analyzer when I use the second calibration procedure as if the whole antenna was hanging directly on the front panel connector of the vector network analyzer. That gives you a very valuable piece of information if you wanted to tune that antenna and you didn't want to know what the transmission line was doing. Well, that was contaminating the results. You're doing the design of an antenna. You don't want to know what the antenna is doing. You don't care about whether or not the guy who uses the antenna is going to use transmission line A or B or length C and so on. And the nice thing about that calibration procedure of referencing the vector network analyzer to the end of the cable is that I might, during my test procedure, let me drop, I might be using a piece of transmission line that has dispersion to it. In other words, real transmission lines in the real world, because they're made out of certain materials, and maybe there's some moisture in the foam, and maybe there's a couple of bumps in the cable and whatever, the cable might have slightly different electronic performance depending on what frequency goes through the cable. It's got higher insertion loss at the higher frequencies. It might have a little bit faster phase delay rate at the higher frequencies. It might have a squeezed point in the middle of the cable where when you swept the cable all by itself, you would be getting bumps in the response of amplitude versus frequency. You'd be getting a scalloped response. When you go through the calibration procedure of referencing the end of the cable, the 12-point correction procedure that's used by Hewlett-Packard and Tektronix and other brands takes all of that into account. That's the magic of this. It thoroughly removes all of the idiosyncrasies of the particular transmission line you're using. Your transmission line, somebody may have bent it too sharp at one portion where it's got a kink. It may have a little drop of water somewhere. Somebody may have stretched it. All of that transmission line characteristic is removed when you do that particular end of the cable calibrating procedure, which some people call normalizing. You normalize to the end of the cable. This is just one of the magic things that a vector network analyzer can do. A vector network analyzer is really good at measuring. Let me drop.
Comment, please.
I'll get you a little later, Howie. It's very good at measuring input to output characteristics of a two-port device, like an amplifier. You can measure forward gain with phase, reverse gain by just reversing the procedure. In other words, reverse the input connector and the output connector. You can put a black box unit at the end of the cable that has only one input connector and find out everything you want to know across your frequency range. What impedance does your black box present to a transmission line? I'm trying to think of some of the other things that you can do with a vector network analyzer. Now, the real magic, let me show you where I...
One more thing. Vector network analyzer or network analyzer with respect to transformers or the open air core transformers or one bar of ferrite transformers.
Let's just shut up.
It turns out that a open core transformer or closed core transformer with ferrite usually has a primary winding and a secondary winding. You could consider the primary winding the input connector of a black box amplifier-like device, and the secondary winding, you could consider the output connector. And could you, with a good vector network analyzer, measure at your favorite frequency what is the response of that air core Tesla coil, for instance? Yes, you could. But you're going to be pushing the characteristics pretty far. Most Tesla coils have a primary to secondary turns ratio. That's a very big number. In some cases, the number is 1,000 to 1 or 10,000 to 1. Because impedance is a function in roughly a function of turns ratio squared, if I had 1,000 turns ratio of primary to secondary winding of an air core transformer, somewhat like a Tesla coil, that means, roughly speaking, the output impedance would be 1,000,000 times higher than the input impedance. Input impedance is the signal you're presenting to the primary winding. The secondary winding, 1,000 turns higher in turns ratio, is roughly 1,000,000 times higher in impedance. That would be pushing the characteristics of a vector network analyzer very far. A vector network analyzer, let me drop, at least one made for the United States, usually is designed around a 50 ohm impedance. impedance. One made for Europe quite often is designed around a 70 ohm impedance. If you're making an